for you. Want to really express our appreciation for those of you that prayed for that radio opportunity with Mike Rosen in Denver. So these will be available first come, first served after the class. Yes, these are the audio tapes of the program. Right. Well, yeah, that made the difference. So, and yeah, for those of you who are in the dark, this is a radio program I was involved in Denver, KOA. It's Denver's largest radio station, and it reaches out to the whole of the state of Colorado and parts of Nebraska and beyond. And it's a secular talk news radio show. So it was the Mike Rosen show, and his is the most popular show on that station. And he set up kind of a debate on creation and evolution with the executive director of the National Center for Science Education. And this is the nation's primary organization to attack creationists. She herself is, she refers to herself as a non-theist. She's an atheist, but she says, I don't like the pejorative term, so I refer to myself as a non-theist. And so she's been going after all these creations. She organizes groups all across the country to go after these people. And then there was supposed to be Ken Ham, who's the executive director of Answers in Genesis, who's a young earth creationist organization, probably the most outspoken of the young earth creationist organizations there and going after the atheists. So Mike Rosen thought this would be nice. He was going to kind of sandwich me in the middle. So old earth creationists. And as it turned out, Ken Ham dropped out because he thought it would be two against one. He has me labeled as an evolutionist. So he said he didn't want to do that. Well, he said, I would go on if you give me twice as much time as you give to the other guests. Or he insisted on bringing some of his people on board to, you know, even things out. And he wound up dropping out. And I got a letter from him this week. And I could tell that he's taken a lot of flack for dropping out of that opportunity. And so he said he just didn't want to face me and Eugenie Scott together. And, well, if you listen to the tape, I made the point, you know, my going on, I felt it was going to be two against one. Because both Eugenie and Ken Ham believe that evolution's efficient. I don't. They both believe the laws of physics fail in such a way as to, you know, eliminate, you know, one side says so that God's not involved, the laws of physics not applying. I believe the laws of physics have always applied. So in that sense, I was ready for, you know, two ganging up against one. And I knew the host wasn't a believer. So then Eugenie Scott's perspective, she says, look, I'm taking on two creationists. Yeah. So she thought she was being ganged up on. We all felt we were being ganged up on. That's all right. You know, I've been on Mike Rosen's show before only for a couple of minutes. But even in those couple of minutes, recognize this guy was going to play it fair. And indeed, he played it very fair. You know, those of you who heard it realize that. In fact, he bent over backwards. When Ken Ham dropped out, he said, I'm only going to take calls from the supporters of Ken Ham's organization. You know, let them represent. And frankly, from my perspective, I thought they did a better job than Ken Ham would have done if he was on there by himself. I mean, they were... You know, they didn't get angry, and they represented his view quite appropriately. So I thought this guy really did bend over backwards. But the letter I got is he wants to debate me on a Christian radio program where the host is a young earth creationist. So that's a nice deal. So, but...
so long as you get twice the time.
There you go. Well... What I don't think he recognized was, because he thought he was going to be debating me and Mike Rosen's show, and I said, well, I'm prepared to do that. But you got to keep in mind, this is a secular radio program. You know, to bring on two Christians on a secular radio program without a secular response, that's not going to fly very well. So I can understand why he brought Eugenie Scott on. I think it'd be fun if they were to bring Stephen Gould in. That could be fun, so... Anyway, that's what I'm going to offer him. Let's do it on Mike Rosen, but let Mike Rosen set the terms. It's his show. So, how that goes. Anyway, this is it. We have 20 copies, thanks to Kathy's generosity. And those of you who don't get a tape, it is on our website. So, and it's also on the KOA website. So lots of places where you can get it. But I think they even make available a transcript. They do. We don't. But we just make available the audio portion. Incidentally, almost every radio program I get to do, we are able to post it on our website. And if you want an audio tape, we can get you an audio tape. Now that we have that radio studio, we're able to capture high-quality audio of every radio interview we do. And almost always, we get permission to make it available. So we got about 30 such episodes that are available. There was a question over here. Yeah. Excuse me. We can do that, too. So. Yeah, and I suppose we could edit out all the ads, too. I mean, some of these radio programs I'm on, it seems to me like it's 50% advertising. And the show is just 50% content. So what we really could do is edit all that stuff out so that, and that way it all fit on one nice little audio tape, right? Okay. For those that are new, we are going through the Bible, picking up all the science and faith issues. Seems like it's verse by verse, but it really isn't. We're just picking off those passages where science and faith issues pertain. But like in the passage we're now in, Genesis 6 through 9, we really are doing verse by verse because every sentence within the four flood chapters has science and faith ramifications. And I was doing that last night, going through the four chapters and saying, is there anything in here that I would delete in terms of not having any impact on science and faith? And it's amazing. Everything stands. You just can't delete anything. Even the story of Noah getting drunk has science and faith implications. So we'll get to that. That's coming. If you ever wondered why, what was going on there about Noah drinking from the fruit of his vineyard, we'll get to that. That definitely has some implications. I wasn't aware of this when I was beginning the writing of the Genesis question. But that there are Christians that are sharply divided on this issue of fermentation at the time of Noah. I said, gee, you know, what a silly thing to fight over. But that actually does go on, that there are elements of the body of Christ that take the position, for example, nothing fermented until after the flood. So, well, I think we can draw up some evidence from the text itself. By the way, I've got a little exercise plan for all of you where we'll do that. We'll actually... No. We're going to look at the passages previous to that story to establish that fermentation really was going on. So, but we'll have fun with that. Okay. But what we've been doing in the last few weeks when I've been here in town, and I will be next week, by the way, I'm going to be in Chicago Monday through Friday doing some radio and TV opportunities, so I appreciate your prayers for that, but I will be back next Sunday. But what we've been doing is looking at this issue of the extent of the flood. And, you know, when I first became a Christian, I had no idea that believers were divided on this issue. But as I've shared with you in previous weeks, there's really very few issues on which the church divides more than the extent of the flood. And often in my speaking engagements, I find that the flood stuff is far more problematic than the creation stuff. And much more likely to be a lightning rod for, you know, fights and disagreements within the church than what's going on with creation. And if you ever read the book by Ronald Numbers, The History or the Evolution of Scientific Creationism, he makes the point that this young earth, old earth conflict really flows out of flood geology, not the other way around. So, you know, most secular people have this idea that this concept of a global flood that destroyed all life on the planet and was responsible for the continents getting to where they are and all the biodeposits being laid down, the fossils being laid down, that was really the foundation for the young earth creationist movement. It didn't come the other way around. So many people think, well, it was the young earth position that rose to prominence and out of that flowed flood geology. Is exactly the opposite. So in that sense, talking about the extent of the flood is really foundational for resolving a lot of these conflicts that Christians engage in. And by the way, as we talk about all this stuff, I'm encouraged in my speaking that these issues that we're discussing that are causing so much conflict are causing less and less conflict as time goes on. These things really are getting resolved, at least from the perspective. I mean, you know, there's a lot of avenues in which I don't have an audience, but I'm seeing much more so today than, say, 2 years ago. The Christian community really is getting a handle on this. It's getting resolved. And as I've shared with you many times, when it gets resolved, God will bless us with another church-splitting controversy that's got nothing to do with the gospel. There has never been a generation of the church that hasn't been plagued with these kinds of issues. And, you know, sometimes we get so frustrated and irritated by it all. But keep in mind that that's one of God's tools for getting the message out. So many non-Christians are prepared to listen to Christian speakers because they're fascinated by the conflict that goes on within Christendom about the flood. They can't understand what's happening here. Seems so incredible from their perspective, and they come and listen. Likewise, this whole thing about geocentrism 300 years ago. The gospel got exposed to a lot of people, otherwise wouldn't have been touched by the gospel because of this conflict within the church. You can read about in the book of Acts. A lot of Gentiles were drawn to the church to try to see what was going on in this fight that was taking place in the first century. Do you have to be circumcised or not? And so that was the beginning of the outreach to the Gentile community. And one other thing I want to say before we get into this flood geology stuff. Every one of these church-splitting controversies, either consciously or subconsciously, usually subconsciously, has the objective of removing the welcome mat for a certain segment of the non-Christian community. I mean, it's really obvious when you read the book of Acts that there were Christians who really didn't want Gentiles joining the church roles. And so they set up a wonderful little controversy that was guaranteed to keep at least the Gentile men out of the church. And likewise, throughout church history, you will see whether it's geocentrism or young earth creationism or global flood geology, subconsciously there is this idea of setting up an issue that will guarantee that certain, what do you call them? I'm trying to think of the word. I'm terrible with words. but certain undesirables out of the church. And, you know, once they become part of the church, we identify another undesirable class. And this is what Paul was saying, that the secret of the gospel, the hidden secret of the gospel for all the ages is God bringing all peoples together under his authority and his love. And how God is doing, or pardon me, Satan is doing his best to prevent that secret of the gospel being manifested within the church. Frankly, that's what attracted me to SMCC back in 1974. Now, walking into this church and seeing barefooted hippies with long hair that hadn't been washed in months, holding a hymnal with a guy in a business suit, three-piece business suit, and obviously they cared for one another and they studied together, and seeing people of all races coming together. And as I looked at that that hippie and that businessman sharing a hymnal, so there's only one thing that they have in common, and that's Jesus Christ. Everything else they don't share in common. And there's only one thing that could cause these two to really enjoy fellowshipping with one another, and that's their common bond in the Lord. You know, and isn't that the secret of the gospel that Paul was talking about in Ephesians? God taking two separated peoples and making them together. So I want to emphasize, as we look at these different controversies, we keep that concept in mind. God's goal is to bring these different people groups together in harmony and unity. But Satan's goal is to mess things up inside the church so that that doesn't happen. And people often think that Satan works through unbelievers. I think much more frequently, as you look at church history, he works through well-meaning, sincere believers. We get used by Satan without even knowing it. All of us do. So when you, I've been called a tool of Satan in some organizations' literature, but I'm thinking about that. Don't we all get duped into becoming tools of Satan in different contexts? And isn't God trying to alert us to watch out for when he is using us. And often he uses us through our own spiritual desires to be spiritual and submitted to God. It's so devious, the techniques that he uses. And one of the exercises in going through all this stuff, because there's another element of the Christian community which is really trying to promote, let's avoid the conflicts. That's what I talked about when I mentioned the creation model in the church service. And by avoiding the conflict, I think we fall even more into the hands of Satan, because we don't get these things resolved. We don't bring the groups together. Okay, so a little lesson out of the book of Ephesians. God's plan is to bring people that have nothing in common, that are enemies of one another, together as brothers under the flag of Jesus Christ. So let's look at this from this perspective. We've been through about half this already, so I'm going to just blast through. Let me try to move this up. All right. Here we go. That's good. Okay. Okay, we got about 17 of these things we need to get through. I'm going to try to pull this up a little bit if I can. There we go. Items on this list about why the flood, though universal, is not global. And it's not so much a local flood versus a global flood as it is a universal flood versus a global flood. Now, they can be one and the same. Global and universal can be identical, but they don't have to be identical. That's their point here. Universality does not always equal globality. It can, but it doesn't have to. And we looked at many passages in the Bible where universal language obviously did not imply globality. I won't go into all the details, but it involves such things as all the kings of the earth coming to visit Solomon to hear of his wisdom from as far away as Ethiopia. So that meant the entire world of Solomon extended only to Ethiopia. Likewise, the faith of the Romans only extended to the borders of the Roman Empire. And so in the context of the dove, in Genesis chapter 8, it says the waters cover the whole face of the earth, but Noah could see the hills and the mountains. So you always have to interpret those verses in the Bible that speak of the flood in universal terms and the context of the antecedent, taking a cue from my English professor wife. And by the way, that applies to all languages. It isn't just English or Hebrew, but every language that rule of grammar applies. The extent of sin is limited. If human beings did not live in Antarctica, then there's no need for God's wrath to be poured out upon the emperor penguins in Antarctica, because human beings had no opportunity to infect those emperor penguins with sin, since they didn't even get close to the place. Limited water supply. To have a global flood with current geography and geology requires 4.5 times the total water content of planet Earth. And so we fall short by 4.5 times. The point here is that Genesis 7 tells us where the flood waters came from, all earthbound sources. Genesis 8 tells us where the flood waters receded to, again, all earthbound sources. What that tells us is that the waters of the Genesis flood are still here. And all the waters of planet Earth, including the oceans, underground supplies, atmosphere, the works, only adds up to 22% of what's necessary to generate a global flood. Okay, the rebuttal to that is to say, well, there were no mountains before the flood, or the mountains got worn down during the 40 days of the flood coming upon the Earth. But that would at least imply that you're having to pop up the mountains and drop down the ocean basins in the 12 months following those 40 days. And there's really no way you could pop up mountains 30,000 feet and have the ark survive, or much else survive. And as I mentioned last time I was here, also built into global flood geology is this concept that there was this one supercontinent in which human beings inhabited, and during the flood it broke up into 7 continents. And by the way, secular geophysicists believe that too, but they believe the splitting took place 250 million years ago, not 5,000 years ago, or 6,000 years ago. But now you're talking 6,000 feet or 6,000 miles of plate tectonics in just 12 months. And in that case, you're not going to get the atmosphere and the ocean surviving, let alone plants, animals, or human beings. Number five, and this is an exegetical argument, the text makes it clear that humanity before Noah, that humanity before Babel, had failed to fill the earth. Human beings were not globally distributed. They were local. And we have God condemning humanity for their failure to fill the whole earth. God gave the command to Adam, you're to multiply and fill the earth. Adam and his descendants failed to do that. We know that from what we see at the beginning of Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 through 6, where God commands Noah once again to do what Adam had failed to do, namely to multiply and fill the earth. When we get to Genesis 11, we're going to see the human race banding together and shaking their fist at God and said, we will build a city and a tower so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth. We'll build this city and this tower so we can remain as one people in one place, united and in harmony. The problem is human unity and harmony outside of the authority of Jesus Christ always works for evil. That's why God had to flood the earth. The human species was using their unity and harmony as a weapon to oppress one another, and to the point where the human species was in danger of extermination. The human species was on the verge of self-extermination when God brought about the floodwaters. And part of that was through their failure to fill the earth. God intended by their filling the earth to avoid the problem of this extreme unity and harmony becoming a recipe for evil. And so what does God do in Genesis 11? He forcibly scatters humanity over the face of the earth for the good of humanity. And that's why Jesus, for example, said, I've not come to bring peace, but to bring division. And we get into Genesis chapter 11, we're going to argue why division is good for human beings. It's good for the same reason that it's not good for United States of American citizens to have AT&T control the entire telephone industry. And so what did our government do? It split them up, created division. Created division for the benefit of the customer. So what do we pay for phone calls now? What, 5 cents a minute? Yeah, we can talk about that some. Let's not talk about that, all right. Okay. Yeah, now you have to dial 15 numbers to get through to whoever you want to get through to. But it's really getting weird for us because, you know, we call in different countries and you have to use a different code for different countries to get the best rate. So I say, well, we can get 9 cents a minute for Canada. We can get 13 cents a minute for Japan, 5 cents a minute for California. But you got to memorize all these codes. Anyway, that's just one of my pet peeves. Okay, number six, lower animals excluded. We did the study. Matter of fact, I should probably wrap this up. We got through almost all of it. But we did? Okay. Well, there's two categories. Number one, what we did is we looked up all the words in the Hebrew for those animals that were taken on board the ark. And then there was a second list for the animals that were left off the ark. But what you discover is there's nothing in the lexical definitions of those different words, and I believe we're talking six different words for the animals that were taken on board the ark, and you have eight different words for the animals that were left off the ark. But there's nothing within those six words that would compel you to interpret it any more broadly than birds and mammals. So we have going on board the ark are the birds and mammals. Noah did not get the command to take on board 1 million species of insects. By the way, I think there's almost that many beetles, never mind the rest of the insect group. So that was not part of it. I think a few beetles might have gotten on board anyway, but that was not part of it. Birds and mammals. You didn't have to worry about the lizards or the amphibians. It was birds and mammals. Yes.
But does that
Okay, good question. Was NOAA bringing on board lions and tigers in addition to these animals that would be helpful for domestication? I personally think he did. That he did bring on. Well, what the text basically says, and by the way, I just opened this up. There are seven different words in the Hebrew for the animals brought on board the ark. And there are nine for those that were left off the ark. And of the seven, basar, which means, creatures with a soulish capacity that have had contact with the human species. You've got bima, which is this beast or cattle. So this would be the long-legged animals that are the herbivores. You've got the haya or kaya. And these are, again, wild animals. And sometimes this word is used to refer to carnivorous lizards. Sometimes it's used to refer only to carnivorous mammals. You have a choice. But again, my point is there's nothing in the text that would force you to the conclusion that it's a bigger group than just the mammals. Yes. Pardon me? No, I'm talking going through Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9, and picking up every single Hebrew word. Remember we did that with you? I just took you through those four chapters, and we picked off every word in the text. And what you'll see in the Genesis question is a list of all those words and what they mean, their lexical definition. The fourth one is nephesh, which means soulish animal. Then you've got the word op, which means bird or fowl. And sometimes this word op is used to refer to large flying insects, but rarely. Usually it's specific just to the birds. Then you got this term remus, which are the short-legged land mammals. Then you got sipper, which means little bird. And it's never used to refer to an insect. I find it interesting that the word op, which can refer to a giant bird, can also be used to refer to an insect, but this word little bird can only be used to refer to a bird. But again, as you go through the list, there's nothing that compels you to interpret any of these animals more broadly than birds and mammals. Your question about domesticated animals versus the carnivores. We do see God making a distinction between the domesticated mammals and all the rest of the birds and mammals taken on board the ark. What's that distinction? Anybody? Pardon me? He takes more. God tells Noah, in terms of your domesticated mammals, take 14. The rest of the birds and mammals, take 2, male and female. One pair only. So in that sense, we would have God saying, of the tigers, 2's enough. If you're talking sheep, take 14. Talking cows, take 14. Goats, 14. I mean, he gives a list of the ones in which he used to take 14. And what you discover is it's limited to farm animals. Farm animals take 14. Any animals used for worship, sacrificial worship, take 14. Everything else, just take 2. But the reason I think it includes the carnivores is what you see in Genesis 1. On the sixth creation day, God says that just before he created Adam and Eve, human beings, he created 3 specialized kinds of land mammals. Short-legged land mammals, long-legged land mammals that are herbivores, and then the long-legged land mammals that are carnivores. And the point is, these are 3 different species of land mammals that God intended that we human beings would cohabit with. What does our sin impact the birds and mammals we cohabit with? And so these are the creatures that are earmarked for destruction because they've been infected by the reprobation of Noah's generation. And as far as the animals that Noah and his family has had contact with, he says, take 2 of each. And the whole point there is God's intent is that we human beings would relate to the carnivores as well as the herbivores. And truth be known, we relate much more closely to the carnivores than we do the herbivores. But there again, God says, you only need 2. You're not going to be eating these animals. 2 is all you need. Herbivores take more, but he definitely wanted us to have the carnivores on board because these are the animals we really enjoy and bring into our homes and adopt as pets. Yes. Okay. Again, the context is that the flood is going to destroy all of humanity and all the birds and mammals associated with humanity. Okay. Same reason that God said, take them on board the ark. Now, he didn't say, take on board flies. There's really no need for God to command Noah to take on board flies because within a few months the flies are going to come in from all the rest of the planet and populate the region of Mesopotamia. They're very efficient migrators. They fill in empty habitats very well. Birds and mammals are the worst at refilling a habitat.
I think the question is flipped. I think he's asking, how do you get rid of all the impact of the reprobation if they escape the flood go elsewhere?
Well, my point is they don't escape very well. So, I mean, if you're, again, I don't think the Arctic tern was part of it. I mean, that's an animal that, you know, travels huge distances. So we're talking about those birds that have had contact with humanity. And so I don't think the emperor penguins are part of it. So God left them alone. Arctic terns, I believe, were left alone. But okay. But if we're talking Mesopotamia, that's a region where you don't get that many migratory birds. I mean, yeah, I grew up in Canada. All the birds migrate in Canada. It's cold there in the wintertime. They're smart. They go south, okay, like a few others that go south, you know, to avoid those Montana winters and all that, right? So, but if you're talking, you know, central and southern Mesopotamia, the birds can stick around. And so they don't move around that much. And God was aware of that, that if these birds were not taken on board the ark, Noah would have to wait a long time for those birds to repopulate that region. And basically God's saying to Noah, I don't want you to wait. I mean, you can do some back-of-the-envelope calculations. If God had wiped out all the long-legged land mammals out of the region of Mesopotamia and its environs, how long would Noah and his descendants have to wait before these creatures reappear in the Mesopotamian Valley? Easily 50 years. Maybe more than 100 years. Likewise, how long would you have to wait for the birds to come back in? Arguably, they might come in a little faster. But birds and mammals will typically only move from where they are if there's population pressure. In other words, if things get too crowded, the offspring of the parents will try to find new geography in which to survive and, you know, maintain it. But that's a slow way to fill in a habitat. And especially for those species that don't produce a lot of offspring. You know, given that birds are only producing, you know, one or two fledglings each time, then it's going to take a while before they begin to fill in a region. Now, some are much more efficient than that, you know, the great migratory birds. But there again, even the migratory birds tend to have very specific habitats. You know, we talk about the swallows returning to San Juan Capistrano. Well, they come to just that one place. Next year, they come back to the same place. So there again, birds are not very efficient at filling out a habitat. They can, but it takes a long time. Yes. Right.
All the people out.
Right. Right. Or at least not taking that many meat eaters on board. And, I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can speculate through this. The text is silent on this issue. I think there's good arguments for saying that it's God, Noah's commanded to take two of every pair of bird and mammal that had any kind of contact with human beings, and that would, of course, include the carnivores. So it's hard to argue based on the text that Noah was selective and left these here. Two points you could make. The herbivores need the carnivores in order to be healthy. And so it's important that the carnivores be present within Mesopotamia after the flood. Otherwise, you're going to have the herbivores multiplying very rapidly, and you're going to see the gene pool collapsing as a result. So you want a few carnivores there. Number two, God knew that carnivores make excellent pets. After the flood, Noah and his family might not have wanted to release these carnivores into the wild, at least right away, because they were enjoying their time with them. You know, we 20th century dwellers may be a little bit out of touch. If you study the culture, say, of ancient Egypt or ancient Rome, you discover that they had many more carnivores as pets than we do. We don't, because they're in such short supply. And so I think, again, you could argue that God didn't want them to be in short supply because of how enjoyable they are for us. You know what the favorite pet was in ancient Egypt? It was the cheetah. That was considered to be the best household pet. I mean, they really relate very well to human beings. We don't use cheetahs as pets today. They're just not available. They're simply not plentiful enough for that to work. So... Huh? They're used for hunting in India. So, yep. Yeah, they make good companions for humans. So, you know, because they can knock down that animal. In fact, there is an interesting partnership. This was noted in the Egyptian annals as well, that cheetahs and human hunters work well together for the benefit of both. There was a hand over here. Yes. Okay, she's raising some excellent points here. I mean, four men, well, the wives, I think, probably got involved too, but, you know, they're good shipbuilders as well. somebody to supervise, right? All right. But the whole point is eight people trying to build this ark all by themselves, even in 100 years, it's quite an undertaking. I mean, this thing was the size of a small aircraft carrier. And you got to find the timbers and put them together and got to pitch this thing. And, you know, it's quite an undertaking. How rational is that conclusion that eight people could have done this even in 100 years? And number two, you know, taking on board all these animals, how could Noah have found all these animals? Okay, couple of things from the text. And by the way, you have to go outside of these flood chapters to answer questions. At least to give a full answer to her questions. But anybody want to offer? Okay. Eight people building the ark in 100 years. How right and reasonable is that? Was it only eight people? What can we draw from the text? Two texts you can go to, this text and Peter's epistles. Because Peter's got some comments on this too. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the analysis of people who have read the New Testament passages on the flood, Hebrews 11 and 2 Peter, is that Noah was probably a mighty prince in the land, and therefore he would have had access to thousands of potential employees to help him in building this ark. Probably the strongest evidence for that are Peter's words, where it talks about Noah being a preacher. Doesn't really talk about his efforts in building the ark. And therefore, a lot of people think, well, Noah spent his time preaching to that wicked generation and really left it to others to build the ark under his supervision. So he wasn't spending all of his time knocking in pegs and sawing wood. He was out there preaching. And in terms of his preaching ministry being effective, hiring hundreds or thousands of people in the business of building the ark would further his preaching ministry. I mean, after all, he's trying to attract a crowd and get the message out. Well, once the boat reaches a certain size, that's going to attract a crowd. You know, here's this guy building this enormous boat in a place where it never rains. I mean, this is really going to attract attention, and people will come. But even more so, if he's hiring all these people to help in building the ark, you know, that's going to get the message out to the workers and their families. So that's one of the answers that's proffered. But keep in mind, the text isn't all that specific on exactly how many people Noah employed in building the ark. There have been those who have made the point, even if it was only 8 people, it could be done in 100 years. It could be done in less than 100 years. Yeah, I don't think there's any argument that he had means. He would have had to have means to do this in any context. So whether he just used his immediate family or he employed thousands of workers, he obviously had to be a man of a fair amount of wealth and prestige in order to get this ark built and to preach to the entirety of that generation. And by the way, it's a principle we see throughout the whole of the Bible. Whenever God is about to pour out his wrath upon human reprobation, he always sends a prophet, and he always gives that prophet a pulpit that reaches all the reprobates. So just taking that biblical principle, you'd be drawing the conclusion that Noah must have been a man of considerable standing and wealth to be able to carry out God's mandate to preach to that entire generation. And that's why most interpreters believe he actually hired quite a few people in the building of the ark. And so he and his sons are really spending their time focusing on the directive of God to preach the message. In fact, I argue in this book that Noah very likely could have done it in less than a year, but that God had him take 100 years in order to have this message go out to the entire generation. So God's intent in Noah taking that long was to make sure that the preaching mission of Noah was achieved. Not the building the ark, but rather the preaching mission. Okay, Wes, then I'll come back to you. Well, I think there is, Wes. I mean, that's another reason why many interpreters have concluded Noah must have been a man of considerable wealth and prestige and standing in his society in order to get this thing done in the face of all that evil. Just like Lot was able to take his position as a judge in Sodom for all those years in the midst of all that evil. It was only because he was a man of such standing in society he was able to survive the onslaught of all that evil. Likewise, that's something we've got to factor in here. Remember when we were reading Genesis chapter 6 and just looking at the words in that community so that he was able to protect himself and his family throughout that long period of time. But people who lacked that position and wealth, you know, they got snuffed out. The human species literally was in danger of self-extermination. The strong were going after the weak and just wiping people out wholesale. But because Noah was so strong, he was able to avoid that during those 100 years. Now, another question you asked, I think we need to follow up. Going after all these animals is a difficult task. What does the text say about that? Pardon me? That's right. That wasn't Noah's job. That was God's job. God brought the animals to Noah, so Noah and his sons and his daughters-in-law did not have the burden of trying to go out and capture all these animals. I mean, trying to capture a pair of wild tigers isn't easy. So, God brought them to him. And again, you know, we think about these carnivores, but if you take the time to tame them, that's what the text says in Genesis 1. They are not easy to tame, they're difficult to tame. But once they're tamed, they'll stick with you. You don't have to worry about where they are. They'll be right there with you. Yes. Yes. Hey, even in our community, you know, when I was a postdoc at Caltech, we had this undergraduate student that came to every class with his pet lion. He had this lioness, and the lioness would just sit there right beside him in the seat, right in front of the professor. Well, no, I mean, he'd always get a seat in the front row so the lion could slide down there with him. So. Well, we all... Yeah, we all got to know that lion. I mean, that lion was such a pussycat. I mean, the favorite thing of that lion was for all these kids to come around and just flop all over her. So I'd be walking through the campus and see this lioness sitting there in the front lawn with all these little kids just flopped all around her, and she would kind of roll over on her back and let everybody, you know, pet her and rub her and all that kind of stuff. So, and the professors all got to like the lioness. But I also noticed that student, though, when it was time to go home, he had the hardest time getting Linus into his truck. Linus didn't want to go home. So he had to really get a bunch of his friends to, you know, talk about trying to pull a mule where it doesn't want to go. Try doing that with a lion. Yeah, we've done that. Yeah, that's coming up, but let me jump ahead and kind of show you that. Okay. What you see there, I believe this is the 600-foot contour of the Mesopotamian Valley. The 300-foot contour is almost as big. But, you know, say the water's flooded up to the 600-foot level, you're covering over 500,000 square miles. It's a big valley. You know, it's a broad valley, too. I mean, what I really have this diagram here for is, you know, people, what you see in the text, when the floodwaters were at their fullest extent, Noah could not see any land. Here his ark was wandering throughout this valley, and he couldn't see land any time. Well, because of how broad this valley is and how long the valley is, it's easy to conceive of Noah being in that ark for months and never seeing land. Oh, this is much broader than the California Central Valley. So, yeah. But, yeah, if you're in the middle of the San Joaquin Valley, you're not going to see land. You're not going to see the high mountains on either side, especially with all of the agricultural haze in there. But this is a much broader valley. So even without agricultural haze, if you're in the middle of that valley, you're not going to see the mountains that exist on these three sides. And because of the way the topography is situated, it's a very flat valley. The water is not going to move. And so this idea, I mean, one of the rebuttals I hear all the time from city folk, hey, you put all that water in that valley, it's just going to rush right out to the Persian Gulf. No, it won't. It's a very flat valley. That water will be standing. In fact, the text tells us how God got rid of the water through a strong wind. The water was evaporated away. And incidentally, that's one of our arguments of why the flood cannot be global. You cannot evaporate a global flood. You can evaporate a local flood. And it evaporated in less than a year. So if you're talking and getting rid of this much water, yeah, that could be done through a strong, dry wind. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Yes. Oh, it does. It comes right down. It comes down to the 300-foot contour. Well, here are the mountains of Ararat, and actually they're much bigger than that. I just didn't put them all in. The mountains of Ararat cover a geographical area of about 100,000 to 150,000 square miles. The entire nation of Armenia in 1919 didn't even fill the mountains of Ararat. In fact, a lot of Armenians go into Pasadena up in Washington Street, and what you'll discover is the mountains of Ararat are synonymous with their nation of Armenia. And those mountains literally come all the way down to the floodplain. In fact, from Nineveh, here's the city of Nineveh. Just outside Nineveh are the mountains of Ararat. So even within the boundaries of metropolitan Nineveh, you'd have the mountains of Ararat. And so I look at that as a probable place for the ark to come to rest. Somewhere up in this region, I believe, is where the ark came to rest, on the mountains of Ararat. So, and by the way, we'll get to that. Everybody quotes Genesis 8:4 as proof that the flood was global because the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. That's not what it says. It says the mountains of Ararat, plural, which could take it right down here. So all these expeditions to search for Noah's ark are looking in the wrong place. They should be looking down here, not way up here. Yes. Oh, you mean down here?
Yeah,
it eventually comes in almost right down to the Persian Gulf. You got some high mountains as you move down towards the opening of the Persian Gulf. I really don't know the answer to that. I mean, certainly you can say it's complete throughout here. Just how far down you'd have to go to see the end of the contour. But yeah, if you go down to the Straits of Hormez, you notice you've got high mountains on both sides of that narrow strait. So somewhere you'll get closure, but I don't know exactly where the closure would take place. Okay. Did I miss a question? I thought I saw another hand up. Okay, moving on. I think I just a few minutes here. Lower animals excluded. I was going to get into the other two words that you see in the text. Remember, seven words for those animals on board the ark. You get two more words for those that were left off the ark. And it's interesting, these two words could include birds and mammals. They're not necessarily specific to birds and mammals. It's the word sherez and yakim. Yakim, animals withstanding. But another definition is animals that subsist. And so there are places in the Bible where the yakum refer to the higher animals. There are places in the Bible where it refers exclusively to the lower animals. Same thing with this word sherez. Could be referring to higher animals, could be referring to lower animals. It's a very generic term. The sherez refers exclusively to those creatures that are small and produce lots of offspring. But again, that could overlap birds and mammals. But the point I make here in the book is this. If you have a flood of this extent, destroying all the birds and mammals that are associated with humanity, guess what? A lot of other species of life will die as well. It's similar to the situation you see in Jericho, where God told the Israelites, you are to kill all the birds and mammals in that city. Well, I believe a lot of cockroaches died while they were knocking off all the birds and mammals. A lot of houseflies died as well. So in that sense, we have the death of a lot more creatures. There's a lot of collateral damage that goes on with knocking off all the birds and mammals. This is not a concern from God's perspective because the collateral damage rapidly repopulates that area. Just like Jericho, you know, I mean, here they go in and they wipe out all the birds and animals. It's not very long before the cockroaches and the houseflies are back into that area. And so some interpreters try to say, well, only birds and mammals were touched. It's really difficult to wipe out all the birds and mammals without getting the death of other species as well. And it's not a pattern. As you go throughout the rest of the Bible, when God earmarks birds and mammals for destruction, we see in each case there's collateral damage. Likewise, we'd expect that here too. But it's not a problem ecologically. They're going to move in quickly anyway. So there's really no need for Noah to take on board such creatures. He's not going to have to wait long before the cockroaches find their way back into Mesopotamia. It's going to happen fairly quickly. Mosquitoes and houseflies as well. Okay. No place names beyond Greater Mesopotamia. And I'm out of time at this point, but one of the things I wanted to ask you is this. Up until Genesis chapter 9, what are the place names in the text? What you discover is there's not a lot of geography in the first nine chapters of Genesis. Anybody got a clue? Mentions four rivers, right? Remember that? Okay, two of the rivers we can identify, two we can't. Which of the two we can identify? The Tigris and the Euphrates. What is the most frequent interpretation of the two rivers that we can't identify? And by the way, the other two rivers, there are no rivers on the planet, either today or in ancient times, that have those names. They're only found in the Bible. Okay. Anybody recall how most scholars try to resolve that problem? Okay, let's bring the math back up. What do we got down here? You have the Tigris and the Euphrates. That's these two rivers here. But look what happens to the Tigris and the Euphrates when you start getting down to the Persian Gulf area. You know, it's typical for a large river as it flows through a flat valley to have a delta where it breaks up into lots of tributaries. What's unique about the Tigris and Euphrates is you really don't get that happening at the mouth. But it happens well before the mouth because it is such a flat place. You get these multiple tributaries that join together. And by the way, it's not just unique to this area. There's one other place where the Tigris and Euphrates split into multiple tributaries that rejoin, and that's up in this area. Up in the Karasatic Mountains, where wheat first was domesticated and spread, if you caught our connections issue. Here, too, we get the rivers crossing over. And therefore, a lot of Bible interpreters say, well, probably different names were assigned to the main tributary, and the side tributaries would have taken different names. And sometimes these side tributaries would become bigger in terms of their water flow than what was called the main tributary. And that may explain why you got four names for the Tigris and Euphrates instead of two. So, some people have tried to tie it into Egypt, but the only reason that's been done is the Egyptians carry these names over with them as they move down into this area. There is really no support for the geographical place names we see in this text being here as opposed to here. Okay, other geography. Tigris and Euphrates and their tributaries. Anything else? Land of Nod. Okay. Where's the land of Nod? East of Eden. Where's Eden? Nobody really knows, but one of the favorite locations is up here or down here. East of Nod would put it over here somewhere. That's still the environs of Mesopotamia. Any other geography? City of Enoch. Okay. Where is the city of Enoch? Nobody really knows. Okay. After the flood, we have six cities named. All six cities are in the floodplain of the Tigris and Euphrates River, every single one. And they're all easily identified. Okay, any other place names? You're missing an obvious one. What are these called? Mountains of Ararat, also Mesopotamia and its environs. You know what? You've exhausted the list. That's all the geography you find. Eden, east of Nod, the city of Enoch. You've really identified the whole list. Mountains of Ararat, the four rivers. There's nothing else. It doesn't talk about oceans or continents or anything like that elsewhere. Then you flip the page, Genesis 10. What you discover in Genesis chapter 10 is you have geography that is truly global in its extent. I mean, you read the table of nations, and this is when God was taking the nations of the world out of Mesopotamia into all the parts of the earth, and you see that all the parts of the earth are represented. Maybe you can argue that North and South America aren't specifically mentioned, but certainly Africa, Europe, and Asia are extensively referenced there in the table of nations. But for the first nine chapters of Genesis, the place names are really no farther than Greater Mesopotamia. So that's another argument that humanity had not become global until after the flood. Therefore, there's really no need for the floodwaters to become any more extensive. Okay, what I'm going to do next week, we're going to start here. So I'm going to assume that you all know about the first day. I'm not going to review them again. But we're going to just start here and move through the remaining arguments that we have for why the flood, though wiping out all of humanity, really can't. Somebody said the one they liked best of all was the olive leaf argument. But anyway, there you go. And for all you petroleum geologists, okay? All right, let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you that this is an issue that's described in your book rather extensively. Lord, we're facing a conflict within Christendom and how to interpret these flood chapters, but thank you for giving us four whole chapters and for giving us so much detail within the text and in the passages in Hebrews and Peter that we really are in a position to answer these issues and to get this problem resolved and, Lord, be ready to face the other church-splitting controversies that you will soon bless us with. Lord, I pray that you would grant all of us the right attitude to deal with conflict within our own community of believers and the conflicts we face as a result outside of our community. Lord, grant us that spirit of grace and humility and wisdom that we can guide people through their mental and emotional roadblocks to receive your truth, life, and love. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.